What I want to look at today is that very first layer of the complex, enormously wide and intricate web of causal chains, causal historical chains, that explain why Cambridge looks the way it does today. That's one way of approaching this. And I think it's an uncontroversial claim to say that the initial causal historical oomph, that's technical by the way, historiographical word, was the belief that amongst the early Christians, widespread, deeply held belief, that the founder of their religion had died, been buried, and rose again. That in and of itself, I don't think, means a great deal. Some do make a lot of this belief, but people die for false beliefs. There was a graffiti I remember in my college at Oxford that said something like, 10,000 Lenins can't be wrong. Well, they can. And maybe the apostles were. Maybe they were sincerely mistaken, or maybe they were fraudulent. That's what we're looking at tonight. The truth of that belief. Now, I'm aware that I risk offending almost everyone launching into an exercise like this. Christians, some Christians and skeptics on one hand and skeptics on the other. For some Christians, in fact, I suspect the majority of my fellow graduates in the divinity faculty here, this whole sort of obsessive fraught debate over God's existence in the Cambridge Union, soporific lectures in a random church from some random graduate student, arguing the case for the reasonableness of Christianity, chipping away at best-selling atheist authors, battling the secular certainness of the day. All of this is felt by the majority of my colleagues in the divinity faculty as a kind of nasty cottage industry. And even worse, some would say an idol factory. It leads to the sort of manufactured God of the philosophers that Pascal railed against in the 1630s. My more Catholic, Anglo-Catholic minded friends will quote me passages after this from Aquinas saying that we can't really know anything about God except what he is not. No, that God exists, but we can't know what God is in any nation. My more reformed friends might quote, will quote Karl Barth at me. Karl Barth is probably the greatest theologian of the 20th century by most measures. Once said that natural theology was not only a bad idea, that is to say, this project was not only a bad idea, but the invention of the Antichrist. And he said that with great seriousness, modifying his musical dictation. Friends of mine with a bit more continental chic will quote Heidegger, the great Martin Heidegger, the great founder of existentialist philosophy in the 20th century, who says that. At one point in 1954, he said that the goal that philosophers come up with, natural relations, come up with, these sorts of historical arguments come up with, is a God before whom man can neither fall to his knees in awe, nor can he play music and dance before his heart. Theism, says Heidegger, is the confused legacy of Judeo-Christian apologetics. And as if to illustrate my point even more neatly in a reason of my supervisor this morning, Norris House Professor of Theology here at Craig Cambridge, it was made clear that she takes something like that line. I'm really sure that it wasn't going to be quite as she might anticipate. To all of these views, there's so much to be said. Just for present purposes, I offer a fairly simplistic response. If you're a Christian, you should take the data of your religion seriously. And as it happens, there are some pretty explicit biblical texts on this question, whether or not it matters that resurrection was a historical event or not. St. Paul's pretty clear. 1 Corinthians 15, for example, if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. We are, of all people, most to be pitied. And then to those who say that all that can be said about God is what he is not, let me quote Cambridge's greatest living secular saint, Simon Blackman of Trinity: a nothing will do as well as a something about which nothing can be said. Hear, hear, Simon Blackman. Those who say that historical assessments of the resurrection reduce God to a human category, domesticated with the tools of the ancient historian, and empty the event of spiritual significance, I think, also have to take very seriously that central strand in the creed that all Christians confess on Sundays, that Christ suffered, died, and rose again. It's a sub Pontio Pilato, under Pontius Pilate, a very concrete, deliberately inserted historical anchor for that creedal claim. So, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not as if we can only properly appreciate the spiritual power and symbolism of the resurrection by evacuating it of historical peril. The two are totally bound up together. There's a wonderful poem, I don't know if you know, by John Updike, called Seven Stanzas at Easter. And he says, just to quote very briefly from this poem, the stone is rolled back. It's not a papier-mâché stone, not a stone in a story, but the vast rock of materiality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. So those are some common theological objections that I'm conscious of. But of course, on the other side, we're faced with the more standard fare from hardline skeptics. People who deny that the historical case for the resurrection is a credible case, or who deny that however credible the case is, it can never prove what it purports to, because dead people stay dead. Didn't you know that? Now, when I was a skeptic, this was largely the line I took, and if I was still a skeptic, I would certainly hold fast to this line. I would avoid any debates with Christians on the historical arguments, because whether at the popular level or the more academic level, I think it's fair to say that the skeptic will lose in that room. And I offer that as an impartial observation from someone who's been on both sides of the fence. I think the best thing for the skeptic to do is to push that empiricist, scientistic line. Empiricism roughly the view that all truths are truths that are accessible through our experience, sense experience. Scientism, scientistic approach, roughly the view that all truths are those truths that are accessible to natural sciences or reducible to things that natural sciences have access to. What you need to do as the skeptic is to adopt that line. That's the strongest and most powerful thing that you could do. And then what happens is the intellectual battle shifts away from history to good old natural theology. And here, I think the challenge for the skeptic is also a serious one, a difficult one, not perhaps insurmountable, but it's a very serious philosophical challenge, shall we say. Why does all of this matter? Well, it matters because when we're approaching the historical evidence, which we'll be doing in the second half of this talk, it's vital to be attuned to what we're bringing to the table. If you bring to the table an a priori commitment, so the notion that dead people stay dead, The deliverances of sense experience and the natural sciences require us to hold on to this in the face of any evidence to the contrary. Then, in a sense, that's a conversation stopper. It doesn't matter how good the evidence is, then your a priori commitments will forbid you from even considering it. So the question then, the challenge then for someone like me is to try to win that person round to altering, modifying the background hypothesis alongside which the historical evidence should be put. And there, as I said, we would move into the arguments of the natural theology. Like, this is not the place to do that, but because there are an awful lot of there's the family of cosmological arguments. Some of you will have come across these many times before. The Kalam cosmological argument, the Thomistic cosmological argument, the Leibnizian cosmological argument, cosmological arguments from motion, from cause, from contingency, from degree. There are teleological arguments, from design arguments, from various features of the natural world, regularity, order, the law-governed character of nature, its unity, its systematicity, its complexity, beauty, marks of intentionality, apparent accidents, intentional content, cosmic constants. There's the family of axiological arguments, arguments that move from claim that God is the best explanation for objective moral truths, for moral realism, that argue the existence of God from the nature of persons, from the nature of value, aesthetic, or moral, altruistic, or normative behavior that is in principle resistant to evolutionary explanation. There are the good old ontological arguments of Ansel, of Descartes, of Leibniz, recent ontological arguments, still, to my knowledge, have not been adequately defeated to the consensus of all Anglo-American analytic philosophers, those that use the tools of the so-called S5 modal logic, the ontological argument of Albert Plantin and Robert Magel. There are arguments from reason, from proper function, from prior arguments of the coherence of hylomorphic or substance dualist solutions to the mind-body problem, transcendental arguments from truth, from testimony, from anti-realism about the mind-independent world, conceptualist arguments from the existence of non-spatio-temporal, causally inert, necessarily existing abstract entities. These could be numbers, propositions, properties, concepts. These are very curious things, spooky things for the naturalist to buy into. One of possibly the most famous, naturalism, roughly the belief that all that exists is natural entities, or entities that are plausibly reducible to natural entities. And perhaps the most famous naturalist of them all in the 20th century was an American philosopher at Harvard for most of his life, William Van Alden Quine. Quine was a very interesting figure, being a philosopher of mathematics and logic. Even he said, look, if we're going to do good science, we need to posit certain entities that are not directly accessible to science. It's really good to have numbers, maths, for example, when we're doing science. And therefore, we must posit those. Very, very interesting. An empiricist who says that we can't just pretend we're making maths up when we're doing science. There must be some realm that is not directly accessible to science, but which we must attribute existence to. Apologies for that tangent. Many more arguments, arguments from the breadth and depth of religious experiences of the transcendent, wager arguments from Pascal, from John Stuart Mill, from William James, arguments from desire, from beauty, from language, from free will. And then there's a whole array of defenses, of course, defenses against the sharpest tool in the atheist's toolbox, the problem of evil. We have free will defenses, the so-called skeptical theist defense, greater goods defenses, Christological solutions, attempted solutions. And you get the idea. There are an awful lot of these. And the issue here is not so much whether or not the empiricist, the naturalist, can show us that those arguments on balance don't prove the existence of God. They need to show us that it is irrational to believe that they don't have a very, very high bar in order to bring a very, very hard hypothesis to the historical evidence that we're going to be looking at. No real possibility at all that there is the kind of God who might have raised a person from the dead. Some do think that. Most philosophers in Cambridge, perhaps, or certainly in the philosophy faculty, will think that. And that is absolutely fine. Very few philosophical arguments can or should go uncontested. But today, I'm afraid, is not the day to contest them. I just want to make it clear that there are no neutral starting points. We all of us bring our own degrees of belief or disbelief on the God question to this edifice. If you are that kind of person, I hope you would still indulge me a little bit. And maybe you're not, but maybe you're someone who's skeptical that the arguments show us anything very conclusive. But there are enough arguments and that enough smart philosophers have held them for the question at least to remain open. But you're an atheist, that you know that you're open to considering more arguments. Then I think the historical evidence might have some traction. It's an intuitive thing, it's a subjective thing, really, but it may well have some traction. You might even be persuaded, as many famous converts have been before you, that the evidence is strong enough not only to support the claim that God exists, but that Jesus is indeed alive. That the same power that transformed him on Easter Sunday can transform your life here tonight and give you a concrete hope for a life of measurable richness beyond this one. That's not an altar call. That's simply to say that the stakes are high. So, the historical case. So many ways of approaching this question. And before I do so, just some methodological rubble clear. What do ancient historians do when they're approaching a historical problem, when they're making a case for totally natural event X having happened at some point? All the reasons for that. Lots of different approaches. But a plausible one is one that philosophers of science are very happy adopting. Pioneered, in fact, recently, in its recent version, by Peter Lipton in the History and Philosophy of Science faculty. Called inference to the best explanation. It's not the only one, but I think it's a plausible one. Inference to the best explanation says that you take the data that you've got, historical data that you've got, and you apply certain criteria to it. Or rather, you apply certain criteria to the candidates that might explain that data. And in order to decide between these candidates, we'll apply, as I said, certain criteria, which hypothesis has the most explanatory power, explanatory scope, explanatory simplicity, plausibility. Peter Lipton said, does the candidate theory have loveliness? Does it fit? It's almost an aesthetic quality he was prepared to argue. Ancient historians, more specifically, will need criteria and tools that the modern historian doesn't really need. Of course, for the modern historian, evidence is not really the problem. In fact, paucity of evidence is not the problem. Quite the reverse. A historian, for example, of the Soviet Union in the Second World War, my next door neighbour is, the challenge there is to get through all the evidence or to come up with a methodology that explains why you're only going to be looking at this evidence and not every single archive in Moscow and St. Petersburg. That's the challenge, the problem, one of the problems of the modern historians. The ancient historians are completely different. You very often got hardly anything to go on. Very few witnesses. Ambiguous archaeological evidence. Hearsay. An incomplete set of evidential data. So, what do ancient historians do? They have to apply certain tools as well. What are those tools? One is multiple attestation. Fairly simple. The more witnesses you have, the more texts you have, the more pieces of evidence you have for event X, the greater the plausibility that event X happened. Fairly straightforward. There are complications, but it's a good working criterion. Another would be, certainly this is used a lot in the case of the New Testament, but more generally as well, the criterion of embarrassment. Where there's a piece of evidence that doesn't put the author or creator of the evidence in a great light, again, this is a psychological criterion, but it's something that should weigh in an assessment. Typically, human nature being what it is, people don't make up things that embarrass them. Similarity. Does the event, or does the account that we're being asked to consider fit in with the thought world of the culture and context that produced it? Is there a discernible continuity with the ideas that are doing the rounds at the time? Coherence. Does the account fit properly together? Are there circumstantial details that would help us? Unwitting details. Sometimes forgeries can be wonderful pieces of evidence when you've worked out that they're forgeries. The question then is if something like ancient history tutor at Oxford would often be very excited about forgeries. Once you found out that forgeries, well, who was the forger? What were they doing when they thought that's forgeries? Very good. Ancient some get very excited about it. Because it's unwitting, indirect, circumstantial evidence. You sort of got into the forger's workshop without him knowing him. That can be gold dust if handled in the right way. And then chronology, early dating. Now again, this is not conclusive. You could have fraudulent historians who got their stuff out very quickly after the event because they wanted to take the spin on it. But generally, it's a sign, and there are two chronological spans to be thinking about. One is chronological span between event X happening and report of event X, and chronological span between report of event X and actual concrete physical evidence in manuscript form or epigraphy or whatever it might be. So those are the two spans, time spans that I'd like you to sort of bear in mind. I mentioned similarity, continuity of the thought world of the culture that produced the piece of evidence, but obligation historians will often appeal to something called dissimilarity. The dissimilarity criterion says that when you're assessing an account of an event, it does help if there's something that plausibly jars about that account. It is something that is broadly continuous, but there's something a little bit unusual. The thought there is if it's too similar, if there's too much continuity with it as well, then, you know, it's something the forger might quite easily have generated and made up, knowing the world, understanding the thought world at this time. This is relevant in particular to the resurrection, as I'll explain shortly. So those are the tools that I'm proposing to use. tonight. Multiple attestation, the first criterion. So, well, let's think about it. The bodily resurrection of Christ, what is that multiply attested? Well, the simple answer is yes, it is. The more complicated answer is that it also depends what degree of dependence you think there might be between the different accounts. So New Testament scholars continue to argue and will continue to argue long after they are dead that over the question of the so-called synoptic problem, so very briefly Matthew, Mark and Luke overlap and share quite a bit of material. Matthew and Luke in particular seem to overlap quite substantially. So you have a text that's posited known as Q, Q short for Quelle, which means source in German. Q is the roughly the kind of hypothetical text that contains material common to Matthew and Luke. Then there is Mark, but there's also thought to be an early layer of Mark. Then there's a hypothetical text that contains material specific to Matthew, that's known as M, and there's material specific to Luke, but perhaps prior to and independent of Luke, that's known as L. Then we have John, of course, and we have 1 Corinthians 15. Those are the sort of sources that people tussle over in these debates. Now, before we look at some of these texts, we need to just have a think about how strongly that criteria, how well that criteria is satisfied. The vast majority of events in the ancient world don't have anything like that spread of attestation. Many events that we just take absolutely for granted, ancient science, absolutely for granted. The invasion of Britain by Julius Caesar. Caesar's crossing the Rubicon, there we go, that's entered our idiom. We've got a very, very patchy, one very patchy source for that event. And you've got Caesar's account, which is a little bit, held in some suspicion by historians. And the manuscript of that doesn't come until, I think, a great deal later, well into the first century AD. So this is, on the face of it, multiple attestation criteria is amply satisfying. Now, if you take a view on the synoptic problem, quite a skeptical line on the synoptic problem, and essentially collapse Matthew, Mark, and Luke into a single source, and it doesn't count. All this funny hypothetical stuff that you're doing in the background, don't buy it. It was probably Mark, most people think Mark was the first gospel, and Matthew was just copied from him, so we'll just give you one for that. You've still got John, you've still got 1 Corinthians 15. Let's think about the chronology here. Gospels, let's say, broad consensus would put Mark at about, 65, perhaps Matthew roughly 70s. So these are very, I'm throwing things out there, but John perhaps 95, and Luke roughly in the 60s perhaps. 1 Corinthians 15, about 51 AD. And more to the point, there is a creedal formula within 1 Corinthians 15 that most New Testament scholars will insist comes from a much, much earlier layer in the Orthodox tradition. I'm going to go through the reasons for that because it goes very directly to this criterion of chronology. So remember, this would be time span 1, time span between event X and first record of X. Let's just have a very quick look at 1 Corinthians 15. Now, brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, on by which you've taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved. If you hold firmly to the word I preached to you, otherwise you have believed in vain. For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance. That Christ died for our sins, according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day, according to the scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas, and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom were still living, but some had fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all of the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also as to one untimely born. First thing to notice, I think, is the circumstantial quality, circumstantial dimension of this passage. It's not an explicit, direct argument for the claim that Jesus really did rise from the dead. It's reminding the Corinthians of what they had believed, trying to get them back on track. So that's nice. It's an unwitting argument. It's an unwitting sort of way of making the case. It's not sort of explicit. It doesn't seem to have a particular axe to grind in this particular context. We've got a list of eyewitnesses. Well, lots and lots of eyewitnesses. I mean, what can we make of that? It's just one source. Well, as I said, New Testament scholars will hold generally very firmly to the idea that this represents a fossilized chunk of the earliest layer of the oral tradition of the early Christian church. Why? The passage I just read out in the Greek is very unusual. It has very unusual for its short but compact series of rhythmic phrases. The word for handed down, paralebe, paralebe, is a word that almost captures a sort of formal transmission, almost as a teacher to a student. Paul's reference to the 12, tois dodeca, is unique to Paul. He normally refers to the apostles. He's never refers to the 12 anywhere else. Cephas, unique in Paul. He normally just refers to Peter. Cephas is, as you will know, the Aramaic name of Peter before he was renamed by Christ. For the sake of our sins, Helekato Namatia is, again, unique in Paul, that way of phrasing it. According to the scriptures, again, unique in Paul. Paul normally writes Gebrata. It is written. It has been written. On the third day, Tehera Ephipe, the ordinal following the noun is, again, unique in Paul. It's not the way we normally expresses time. Was raised, perfect passive there, unique in Paul, except for another critical formula, a known established critical formula he uses, I think, in 2 Timothy somewhere. You get the picture. The historical case for this being a very, very early critical formula is as strong as we get in ancient history. So where do we date it? Well, very little. But again, it would be perfectly acceptable in the New Testament senior seminar and divinity faculty to hear views that would say, you know, probably quite liberal, even skeptical views that would be comfortable dating that creedal formula to 35. So what does that mean? I might say, well, look, it's still 6 or 3 years after the resurrection, the legend that happened. And it's in a text that dates to 51, so that's 2 decades or so after the alleged event. Fair enough. In modern historiography, you might have a point. But in ancient history, these time spans are quite extraordinary. Ancient historians, I remember this when I was studying classical ancient history at the university. Time spans like this are just not just didn't exist. And I cannot think, I've racked my brains the last few days for an event that has this sort of brevity between record and event itself. And there might be some out there, but this criterion again is satisfied in an eminently plausible way. I could go on, but I'm conscious of the time here, and I want to hear what you have to say as well. So let me just sort of move on a little bit and move some of the other criteria to one side and get to the actual the main strands in the case for the historicity of the book of resurrection. Point number one, the burial of the body and the immediate public proclamation in Jerusalem of the resurrection. This is well attested. It's something which we're fairly comfortable with. There was a death and that there was a burial. Some 20th century theologians, for reasons that I hinted at the beginning, would prefer to say no, that what was on the cards here was a spiritual resurrection, a kind of reawakening of or an intensification amongst the apostles of the memories of their time with Jesus. That though they were disillusioned and disappointed and disbanded and deceived, they, after a time, came to think back to the life of Jesus and try to make sense of it, as if it were some spiritual resurrection in their community, in their hearts. Now, this is just an invention of 20th century theology and 20th century sort of skeptical lines. It could not be more different from the beliefs, the set of beliefs that Second Temple Judaism had at this particular point in its history about the resurrection. The history of those beliefs is a long and complicated story, and I'm not qualified to hold forth on it, but very, very briefly, it was on the edge of their thought world. So the very famous text, 2 Maccabees, chapter 7 of 2 Maccabees, there's a text from a so-called Apocrypha, intertestamental texts. But there we have some quite sort of full-blooded beliefs about bodily resurrection. But it was bodily resurrection at the end of time, at the end of history. Now this is thought to satisfy, by some, it's thought to satisfy the similarity, dissimilarity criteria quite neatly. Because what it says is that bodily resurrection wasn't so off their radar that it's something they would just completely pluck from nowhere. It does make some kind of sense. It was part of the kind of furniture of their thought. But there's dissimilarity too, because it was very specifically a belief in the bodily resurrection at the end of time. It's a so-called eschatological belief. If you don't know what eschatology means, don't worry, it's not the end of the world. So that criteria is met quite neatly. Data number two, the empty tomb tradition. The empty tomb, of course, is important. It's a necessary condition for the historical case for the bodily resurrection. It is a necessary condition, but it is not a sufficient condition. When we come to the multiple appearances, these are really everything can be boiled down, in a sense, perhaps, to two pieces of data. 22, multiple appearances. Each of them independently is not a sufficient condition. So what are we to make of the empty tomb tradition? Well, big debate over whether or not the empty tomb is assumed in that passage that we just read, that I just read out from Paul. My mind's not made up about it. I see arguments for us, the arguments against. Those against say, he doesn't mention the empty tomb. Well, that's fair enough, he doesn't mention the empty tomb. Those in favour say, well, he doesn't mention the empty tomb because it was just so obvious. I mean, he was buried, died, then he rose again. And if you're dead, you get buried, and you rise again, then you leave an empty tomb behind. And this is why I have the tomb. But that seems a positive thing to do. Well, this is where Jewish belief comes in. So, well, what did Jews of the time believe about bodily resurrection? Well, this is where things get conjoined with this spiritual resurrection position. So if you think that resurrection is not actually bodily, it's just a spirit, goes, it gets released, or a sense of warmth in your heart, you're happy to call resurrection, then yes, saying someone was buried, died, and spiritually resurrected, qua sense of nice warmth in their heart, then yeah, you're not going to have an empty tomb. But, so you have to take it alongside what you think Jews thought about what the resurrection was like. As I said, the evidence is that Anastasis resurrection meant what it said on the tin, bodily resurrection. So there's the debate of 1 Corinthians 15, but of course, in Mark, it's pretty explicit. Luke, Matthew, John. Some confused accounts, perhaps. Possible inconsistencies, skeptics will allege. I think there are inconsistencies of sorts, but the inconsistencies don't strike me as fundamental. The inconsistent, I worked as a lawyer before coming to Cambridge, and witness statements that were identical were treated with skepticism. It's implausible to suppose that we would have accounts of an event like this, a panic, confusion-inducing event like this, and get identical accounts. If we did, I'd say that really would be grounds for skepticism, seems to me. But again, it depends how you come to the evidence. If you're coming with a skeptical view, or my skeptical view, they take a different line. So, the empty tomb tradition, we talked about the burial and the immediate public proclamation in Jerusalem, in the very place where the event is alleged to have happened. This is interesting because the early movement's enemies had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to discredit the account if they could. All they needed to do was go to the tomb, produce the body. But our very, very earliest evidence of the Jewish authorities' reaction is not, let us show you the tomb, is it? It's the disciples stole the body. Right. It's an arrival explanation for an empty tomb. Third, women discover the tomb. You might have heard this one before. Women discover it in all the accounts. Again, goes very, very deep chronologically within the oral tradition. It takes a very great leap of historical imagination in our Enlightenment times, from our Enlightenment times into the attitudes and structure of beliefs about the status of women in first century as women, the evidence of women formally, forensically before the law was judged to be absolutely inferior to that of male witnesses. So much so that it would take three, the evidence here suggests that it would take at least three women eyewitness accounts to overturn the eyewitness account of a single male witness. A couple of illustrations for you. Prayer for an unborn child from the Talmud. Oh God, let not my offspring be a girl, for very wretched is the life of women. Morning prayer. The men blessed God. God, we bless you. I bless you, you who has not made me a Gentile, a slave, or a woman. You see where this is going. You will have perhaps been aware of this sort of argument before. If you're going to make something up, you pick your witnesses carefully. You pick your fictional characters carefully. Why pick them? It makes no sense. And this is true. Fact number four, the multiple appearances, which, as I said earlier, is as a logical matter structurally complicit with the dating of the empty tomb. What are we to make of multiple appearances? Well, multiple attestation, good chronological strength, different circumstances, different occasions. It's not a sort of single collective hallucination. We're told they happened over a period of time, different places, different people, different numbers of people. Some Jews, some not. Some believe, some don't. They don't just involve visions, sight, touch, conversation. Polysensory experiences. We've got the appearance of Peter, mentioned by Luke, and Paul to the 12 apostles, mentioned by Luke, John and Paul to the women, multiple women, multiple appearances to women, Matthew and John. The breadth of independent sources here. Time's moving on. Fact, datum to be explained, explanandum number five. Fact and degree of the early church's belief in the resurrection. Well, you can sort of tack that on to the point I was making at the very beginning of the talk. The fact that the early Christians grew as fast as they did and ranged as widely as they did is not really something to be questioned. We know from extra testamental sources. Tacitus, for example, has a very grumpy passage in chapter 44 of the book, the Kingdom of Islam. He talks about Nero scapegoating the Christians. When was Nero scapegoating Christians? About 64 AD. So again, that is a 30-odd, pre-decade-odd chronological interval between what? Between alleged resurrection and a group of people causing trouble at the heart of the Roman Empire, who were recognizable enough to be credibly scapegoated. This is obviously before EasyJet. Not easy to, but hard enough to travel there, hard enough for a group of people to travel there. For a movement to spread there and to settle there, and to settle there in a way that began to be politically subversive. Well, we don't even, as far as we can tell, think that they had explicitly political intentions. Of course, a corollary of early Christian belief about who was in charge was that Caesar wasn't. So, indirectly, there is political subversion. So that fits with Nero wanting to scapegoat. It fits with the letter that Pliny writes to Trajan, Urbane's letter, in the 2nd century or so. fascinating. Chinese government of Virginia on the chunk of modern day Turkey. Emperor, what do I do with these people? I come in with him. They're very, very curious. They meet together on the first day of the week. They eat their god. They indulge in incestuous love feasts. What should I do with these people? I tortured a couple of their slaves, but I can't get anything more than they told me before they tortured. Inflation rates are a wonderfully dry response. Now's not the time to go into it. But it takes the meeting on to the final piece of financial data. I've called this rather clumsily radical changes in liturgical practice. That's being very serious last time. So three things that the early Christians dropped. Jewish aura observing, temple attending Jews. Silent drop. Urn. Very early on. Animal sacrifice. The binding authority of Mosaic law. And belief in a conquering Messiah. Or belief in a particular kind of Messiah. They dropped all three of those. Those of you who know are friends with observant Jews will know just what that means, how destabilizing that must have been. And we know that. And Galatians, Paul's letter to the Galatians, is effectively all about that. A good chunk of Acts is all about this tension. What do we do? Are we still Jews? We do that circumcision. What do we do about that? Good purity, of course, so on. You're asking us to do this because you think the Messiah has arrived. But this wasn't the Messiah that we were thinking of. We wanted the Messiah to throw off the shackles of Roman imperial domination politically, to restore temples. But he's gone the way of every other would be Messiah, death on the cross. Messiah. In fact, we've got evidence for about 15 would-be messiahs, roughly between 6 BC and 135 AD, the last great movement of Jewish resistance against Rome. And it's a fairly predictable story. Messianic pretensions, often a kind of incipient and armed movement of political resistance, squashed and very publicly too, and in some painful and humiliating ways. Does that pattern fit the account that we have in the New Testament? Actually, not at all. We have, if anything, in reverse. We have a figure, a messianic, a would-be messiah, who isn't directly or at least militarily provoking the authorities that were in charge at the time. Of course, he's doing actions that aren't interpreted as being subversive, but that doesn't seem to be his intention. What we see in the New Testament is a figure who withdraws, doesn't like to get caught up in the fray until the time is ready, until the time is right, but he doesn't seem to be interested. Forming some kind of political organization or reclaiming Jerusalem from the Romans. And then disbanded group of followers, death, humiliated the public death. And then what? Not movement dies out as all others did very quickly. Dusty journals of New Testament studies in the University of London. Quite a reverse. A group of people who have committed and prepared to die for, that's the same, prepared to die for, be executed for their belief that their founder had overcome the execution dealt by the Romans. Those are three practices that were dropped. Animal sacrifice, Mosaic law, and this very particular belief in a political sign. Three practices that were adopted. There were others, but three practices we know were adopted very early. Plenty, first day of the week, Sundays. Why Sunday? Those of you with Jewish friends will know how holy the Sabbath is. The Sabbath is so holy that you've got to start getting ready for it on Friday night. You know, you get ready for it. Friday night. Switch. Immediately. Very, very early on. Switch to Sunday. First day of the week. Why? And why is that a detail? Is that plausibly a detail that would have been made up in those accounts? Well, maybe it's. See, it's sort of take the art of a novelist to think something like that. It doesn't fit with some of the genre of ancient biographies that we know it. Sundays, the first day of worship. Two, baptism. Baptism is a sign of the covenant. Very unusual. We know John the Baptist picked it up as a practice, but you got into trouble with that. It's not part of the way you did things. You were born in Judaism. You didn't need some fancy ceremony or our mitzvahs and so on, kind of coming of age ceremonies, but not an admission ceremony. Three, communion. The Eucharist is an act of remembering Christ's death. This is why many thought that the early Christians were cannibals. They keep talking about eating their God. What does this mean? Strange and a difficult datum to explain, if not by the explanation of the historical body resurrection. Whilst we're on that, Romans also, of course, thought that the Christians were atheists. They're atheists for the Romans because they didn't have any places of worship. Where did they go? They didn't have temples. They meet in each other's houses. Where is their God? Where are their statues? And they claim to be believing. They claim to believe in God, but we can't see their God. We don't know what their God looks like. That's all atheists. And they certainly don't seem to sign up to the gods that we believe in, the gods of the empire. They're not sacrificing when we tell them to. None of the other non-Roman religionists do this. What's their problem? They just don't like gods. They don't like any gods. And thirdly, the incest objection, incest charges that were there from the early age. Of course, this is almost certainly from the early Christian practice of referring to each other as brothers and sisters. And, again, that's something we have evidence for from early on. The idea that the early Christians saw themselves self-identifying as a family, but a father. Again, strange, jarring set of beliefs against the backdrop of Second Temple Judaism. I'm conscious that time is moving on, and David, what time? I'm conscious that I would like to open things up a little bit to others. So let me draw things to a close. We've looked at two very broad aspects, and I'm conscious we've looked at them very, very quickly, and perhaps you might feel rather controversial quickly. We've looked at the philosophical backdrop, I suppose one might call it, what we bring to the table, at least before we assess the evidence, the claims that we make about reality, what we think we're committed to, about the way the world is, whether it's a naturalistic view of the world, or whether it's a view of the world that is broadly naturalistic, that is prepared, when pressed, to think about making non-natural entities into that metaphysical framework. And then we moved on to the subject of appreciating evidence of the historical evidence itself. And perhaps I should just close by saying that this might have seemed a little bit dry to you, but to reiterate what I said at the beginning, this is right at the heart of the content of Christian belief. The historicity of the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ is not the whole deal. It's not the Christian faith. But it is a necessary condition for it, from my point of view, anyway. Who am I to say who's in and who's out when it comes to membership of the worldwide Christian family? So let me just speak for myself. If it turned out that an ossuary with the bones of Christ turned up tomorrow in the bowels of the Vatican, uncovered by some young, intrepid reporter on a torchlight, shattering all the hopes invested in Pope Francis I, I often think, how would I respond? And I think I would, I'd stop going to church on Sunday nights. I really like long hot baths on Sunday nights. I really like Sunday papers on Sunday nights. I go to one church, so it's not as bad as all that. But the point is that Christianity has ceased to me to be something that is worth committing my life to. I might, I suppose, think that it's an attractive ideology, perhaps, a great teacher line. Of course we should love our enemies as ourselves, and there's a lot of spiritual depth there. I might be attracted to it a little bit, like Cambridge undergraduates were attracted to Marxism in the 60s, or frankly, well, here at least in the 30s. But I don't think it's something I would invest myself in existentially. There are some who do, as I said, I wouldn't dream of trying to contradict them on that point, but there it is. That would be my take for what it's worth. Thank you all so much for hearing me out.